Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Paul Ray, who is a professor back at Hillsdale's College. He's written a fascinating book called Soft Despotism, Democracy's Drift. And you know, as we look and see what's happening in America today, why we find that the Obama administration says they don't want to run the car industry, but they are running the car industry. They forced the CEO of General Motors out of office and replacing the board. They have a 31-year-old MBA just out of college running one of the largest corporations in the world today. And of course, they're forcing the company to close down about 2,000 distributors, car distributors. Why would they do that? I mean, after all, if they're not making any money, why, they'll go under. If they're making money, why not allow them to continue operating? Where does the government get off interfering in a bankruptcy? And, of course, they're going to see that the major banks, J.P. Morgan and Chase and Goldman Sachs, are going to get all of their money out. Most of the people, the bondholders, stockholders, aren't going to get much of anything. But J.P. Morgan, Chase, and Goldman Sachs are going to get their money paid off because they had derivative contracts, and we're going to be sure those insurance contracts, we're probably going to pay for it. The taxpayers are going to pay for it. But those big banks are going to get paid off. Most people are going to lose all of their investments. And well, that doesn't seem to be quite fair, does it? Of course, they're actually selling off parts of the company. They're selling off the Hummer division. They're selling off the Saturn. Where does the government, though, get off going in and supervising a bankruptcy? And the same thing with Chrysler. A lot of people are objecting to it because the state of Indiana is going to lose a lot of their money that they've invested, the pension funds. But they're saying, well, you don't have any right to complain. The Obama administration has determined what's going to happen. Now, where did they get the authority to do that? There are laws as far as bankruptcy, but those laws no longer apply. We're moving towards a situation where the people who control the executive branch of government can put aside all the laws in the name of, oh, well, this is an emergency, we know what's better, we're here from the government, we're to help, and we're going to get things straightened out. Well, with that as a background, and the fact that certainly the Obama administration is telling bank executives how much salary they can get, and whether they like bank executives, whether they think they get too much money, if they can tell the bank executives how much money they'll make, what about you out there in the audience? Dr. Paul Ray has written a fascinating overview of America's history and how we came to have the sort of government we have. And this book deals with Montesquieu, Rousseau, Tocqueville, and what's going on in our country today. And a lot of people say, well, so what? Well, so a great deal. This is the very essence of our country, and if you don't understand the essence of America, you can't understand why what's going on today is going to lead to the end of freedom as we know it. Dr. Ray, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Why don't you just pick up the story? Tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and how it was that you came to write a book on Montesquieu, and most people don't even know who he was, and yet he was instrumental in creating the freedom that we have today.
I'm an historian. I was trained at Cornell University and Yale University and had a Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford. I thought I was going to be an ancient historian. I stumbled into writing comparative history, the history of self-government from antiquity to the present day, in a book called Republics Ancient and Modern that was published in 1992 and still in print in the 3-volume paperback edition.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Paul Ray. Go right ahead, please.
In the aftermath of that, one of the reviewers who liked the book very much criticized it on one particular, that I didn't pay enough attention to Montesquieu's Spirit of Laws, a book published in 1748 that had an immense impact on everyone in the 18th century and on the American founding fathers in particular, providing them with the account of the separation of powers that underpins our Constitution and with that of federalism, which are the two principal doctrines underpinning our Constitution. And I turned to work on Montesquieu as a consequence of this criticism, and as I did, I began to notice more and more his focus on political psychology, and in particular his account of the political psychology of the English form of government, which was the precursor to our own form of government. And one of the things he emphasized was it was ideally situated to provide people with political liberty in the sense of security and rule of law and self-government, but that it didn't leave them with the psychological sense that they were secure. In fact, it left them with a sense, and he used the word inquietude, which means uneasiness, anxiety, fear without a certain object. And he raised the question whether this underlying sense of fear might lead them on to despotism, because what they would seek is security from a central government. And he thought they would avoid this because the main sources of wealth in their society were private and not public. They didn't really have to do with patronage. Rousseau read this and took up the theme, and he argued that inquietude was much more serious matter than Montesquieu had taken it to be, that it was tied up with the very nature of commercial societies in which one day you're up and the next day you're down, that it's tied up with the fact that commercial societies have a tendency to encourage you to compete with your neighbors in gaining possessions that give you very little in the way of happiness, but there's a vanity that is predominant, and that leaves you with this feeling of inquietude. And he suggested what you needed was radical equality of the sort that the Obama administration has embraced as an antidote to that. Tocqueville read both Montesquieu and Rousseau, and he looked at it and he said, no, the solution is not radical equality. That is, in fact, the source of the problem. The reason that we experience this sense of vague anxiety.
I'm going to ask you just to hold that thought for a moment as we bring all of our stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Ray had written a book on the history of America, but of course his original book, written in 1992, didn't go into Montesquieu, because here was a philosopher who had a profound impact on the thought of the founding fathers of America. His book was written, I believe, probably in the early 1700s, or late 1600s, early 1700s, talking about, of course, this idea of the separation of powers, and based upon what existed in the British government, that this was a very good form of government, probably the best form of government, as long as you could divide the power so no power could regulate the people. But unfortunately, the population many times would still have a feeling of unease simply because of what was going on. Of course, Dr. Ray then talks about the concepts as they were laid out by Rousseau, who read Montesquieu, but he felt, of course, that you had inequality. What you need was radical equality, everybody being forcibly equal under the power of the central government, no one group having the ability to have more than others did. And, of course, de Tocqueville, a French philosopher who came to America in the 1830s, had read Montesquieu and read Rousseau, and of course, and I'm going to let you tell our listeners about de Tocqueville, because he really felt that the situation that existed in America in the 1830s was just about as close to ideal as possible. Pick up the story there.
Well, he worried, as did Montesquieu and Rousseau, about the psychological disposition of uneasiness, anxiety, fear without a certain object that liberal, commercial, democratic societies seem to evidence. And it worried him, especially in his native France, that in this situation, out of a sense of anxiety, people would look to the central government for help. at every turn. And it was his fear that with this help would come strings attached, that with this help would come control. That is to say, you would trade your liberty for the promise of security, a promise that really couldn't be kept. But out of your anxiety, that's what you would drift gently, unobtrusively, and unawares towards. In America, in the 1830s, he thought he found the remedy when he visited the United States. And the remedy that he found in America was that the Americans had local self-government, which the French didn't have. And they had the experience of joining together with their friends and their neighbors and their family to solve problems. They had the experience of civic agency, of being real citizens, not nominal citizens who voted every so many years, but citizens who actually participated in governing themselves. From this, they learned what he called the art of association, the art of joining together with their friends and their family and their fellows in private organizations with public purposes, charitable purposes in many cases, building hospitals, building schools, building churches, building roads, taking care of the poor in local areas. So that they learned not only to act through public institutions, but through private institutions with a public purpose, and they had a sense of themselves as citizens, so they weren't helpless. They didn't experience inquietude, uneasiness, anxiety, fear without a certain object, because the problems that they faced, they could face, and they could face in tandem with their friends and their neighbors and their associates. The third thing that distinguished the Americans from the French is that they were seriously religious. And though they might be divided into Catholics and Protestants and 1,000 Protestant sects and Jews and so forth, nonetheless, they all had a sense of themselves as children of God and of having dignity, a species of dignity that meant they really couldn't be run over. Encroaching on their liberty was encroaching on their dignity. They also had a strong sense of morality, of right and wrong, which anchored them, which meant they weren't restless, they weren't anxious, they weren't uneasy with regard to how they should live their lives. They had moral guidance and clear moral guidance, and they had it in common. They weren't really at odds with one another over these questions. Finally, partly as a consequence of these religious commitments, they had strong, strong families. Montesquieu commented once that a Frenchman does not like to speak with other men about his wife because he fears they may know her better than he does. Adultery was very common in France, and this was true in Tocqueville's day. In America, it was almost unknown. And Tocqueville greatly admired American women. They chose their own husbands, which French women tended not to do. They had them chosen for them. And they made canny choices. They thought long and hard about them. They stuck to the decisions they made. And he thought they were the ones who made the American families work. The consequence, however, was in family life, one did not experience uneasiness, anxiety, fear without a certain object. So Americans were confident, where the French were timid. Americans experienced civic agency, where the French were passive. Americans were self-governing in the fullest sense of the word, where the French weren't. And his fear was that France would drift on to a species of despotism that needed a new word for it, and he called it soft despotism. It was soft because the government was kind. It pretended to take care of you. It was providential in character. It replaced God. It replaced the family. It replaced local magnates. And you became subject to it without even noticing that you were gradually becoming subject to it because you were always asking for help. One of the themes of my book, which, by the way, is now in its second printing and is, thank God, now in the warehouse of Yale University Press, and later this week should be available again from Amazon.com, and you could find it at my website, www.paulaerahe.com. The theme of the last part of my book is that we now look more like France than we look like the America of Tocqueville's day. Local self-government in the United States is increasingly under the supervision of the federal government. The most extreme cases right now where California, in trying to balance its budget, ineffectively, but nonetheless, in trying to balance its budget, passed a law that involved cutting the salaries of certain people, and Barack Obama, the President of the United States, told them they couldn't do that. Dictating to a state, and let me add, the largest state, with something like 10% of the American population, federal help, by way of federal grants, to state governments, local governments, to school boards, to private universities, to state universities, to General Motors, to Chrysler, and whoever else, always comes with strings attached. And those strings don't have so much to do with, we're giving you this money for a purpose, spend it for that purpose. They go well beyond that. We're giving you this money, and we're going to tell you how to do everything else that is associated with your activity as well. The consequence is to be a state legislator is to spend most of your time trying to conform to federal guidelines that come with these grants. And that's true of city governments, that's true of school boards, that's true of private universities, that's true of state universities, not of Hillsdale College, however, which refuses federal help and is therefore independent and free. It's obviously true of Chrysler and of General Motors. The President of the United States is the one who's going to decide which factory gets closed and where the headquarters gets placed. There's the pretense that he doesn't, but he always seems to be able to make a phone call to reassure people about what's going to happen, which means he's in on the decision-making. Everything becomes centralized.
And, of course, the thing is the hypocrisy is why we don't want to run the automobile industry, and then they go right ahead and run it. I mean, is he telling the truth? Of course
he's not telling the truth.
They want to run the automobile industry. They want to run every aspect of our lives and provide us with health and education and welfare from the cradle to the grave, but with that comes control, and I share your concern. We are moving away even from soft despotism towards an increasingly hard form of tyranny.
Well, the element of it that it's hard is businessmen are afraid to speak up. They're afraid to speak up because they fear retaliation. And that fear is genuine. This is a government that means business, and it means to have its way, whatever the cost. It may be the case that soft despotism never stays soft, because once that power, that leverage, is in the hands of a central administration, surely they are going to use it, and they're going to use it to police you and to force you into conformity with what they intend. We have had three great surges in this direction, two of them in the 20th century and the third taking place right now, one under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal, the next under Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Great Society, completed by Richard Nixon, let me add. Republicans have not firmly resisted this, except in part Ronald Reagan. They have actually cooperated. They're in disagreement with the Democrats about the pace of the extension of the intrusiveness of the centralized administration. They very rarely object to the direction that we're going. And the third, of course, under Barack Obama. The foundations were laid in 1913. With the passage of the 16th Amendment legalizing the federal income tax, which gave the federal government unlimited funds if it needed them, and the 17th Amendment decoupling, also passed in 1913, decoupling the state government from the federal government. Prior to 1913, under the old Constitution, the Senate was chosen by the state legislatures, which meant that the Senate wasn't going to run roughshod over the state legislatures. But the direct election of senators reduced the capacity of states to prevent federal encroachment. And ever since then, at differing speeds, at differing times, the federal government has become ever more intrusive. In the area of private associations for public purposes, our charities, most of them now are lobbying organizations in Washington with tin cups asking for federal money.
And of course, one time, of course, this was all illegal. We have a constitution. It limits the power of the federal government with the 10th Amendment, the 9th Amendment. Most of what's going on today is simply unconstitutional, but who will speak out for the constitution? Who will enforce the constitution? It is the law of our land. We've had an awful lot of people in Washington, D.C. who have a different agenda. We'll be right back in just a moment with Dr. Paul Ray. You go right ahead.
Do we have an audience?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, good, good, good. I didn't know that.
Well, basically, what happens is we lose some of our stations, but we still have our local.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Neighborhood organizations, which is really organizations like ACORN and others that are there simply to fix elections. And certainly we've seen this tendency for people from the graveyard to vote, for illegal aliens to vote, for people who really are totally unqualified to vote. And the old saying is, vote early and vote often. And unfortunately, they have compromised our electoral process. Certainly the census can be used to reapportion congressional districts so they will favor the party in power, which wants to stay in power forever because they don't believe in representative government. It's all about power and centralizing it in the hands of a few people. But pick up the story from there, please.
The model is Chicago, where there are elections every 2 years or every 4 years for all of the offices, but you know who's going to win because everything has been fixed, and it's been fixed for something like 70 years. This is aiming at doing this on a national scale. And they have made considerable advances in this direction. But as I began to say, the Tea Party movement is a sign that there's beginning to be resistance. And Tocqueville would find this moving. When he came to this country, one of the things that struck him was the resistance against Henry Clay's tariff of 1828, the so-called Tariff of Abominations. He didn't know whether the Tariff of Abominations was an evil or not, but he thought that the civic agency of people who organized in every state of the Union against the Tariff of Abominations was a sign of the spiritedness of the American people and of their capacity for self-government. They organized outside the two political parties, the Whigs and the Democrats of that age, and they brought pressure to bear on them. I think something similar is happening with the Tea Party movement. It sprang up because of a remark on CNBC, and out of nowhere, all over the country, there were demonstrations against what the Obama administration was doing. I think there are other signs of this. Those of you who live out in California know it's not been reported much nationally, but you know that there was an attempt to raise taxes massively in California and to do so through a plebiscite, and that people in California voted 2-1 against raising those taxes, and that there was another measure on the ballot to freeze the salaries of legislators in times like these, and they voted overwhelmingly, apparently every single county in California, even San Francisco, voted in favor of this. This is a sign that this is not what the American people want.
But, of course, you know, the people in the legislature really don't care what the people want. In fact, you know, initially when the votes came in, they were trying to figure out in Sacramento how to get around the people, and apparently there was enough a furor that was raised there, and the Republicans pointing out this is the way the people voted. Why do you want to go against the people's vote? That eventually the Democrats were, who are a vast majority, almost a two-thirds majority, but not quite, in the state legislature, they were forced, they were shamed into being forced not to try to circumvent the will of the people, because these are elitists. They have an agenda, and they don't care what the people think.
No.
It's only the fury of the people that they fear.
Right, but the fury, I think, is coming. And when the fury comes, they will care. And before the great wave breaks in 2010, the great electoral wave, what you will see is some of the Democrats running away from their own records of support for the Obama administration on all of these measures. Let me add that the other thing that gives me hope, and the extremism of the Obama administration, the obtrusiveness of it, is I think, grounds for hope, because the drift towards soft despotism has taken place generally because people don't notice that it's taking place. It's gradual. The government helps you with this year, and it helps you with that the next year, and yes, there are these requirements, and the next thing you know, you're all bound up with these requirements. Here, what's happening is a revolutionary move over a very short period of time. It's in the middle of an economic crisis, which gives them what they take to be cover, but I think it's going to blow up in their faces, and the reason is, economically, we don't have the money to pay for these measures. The Social Security Fund will begin to be depleted very soon. The Medicare funds are already in crisis. This is before we adopt general socialized medicine. We can't pay for this without raising taxes massively. And the American people in California, anyway, which is not a right-wing state, have shown they do not want a massive increase in taxes. Furthermore, if you do have a massive increase in taxes, it will stunt economic growth, which will make it even harder to pay for things. Margaret Thatcher once said the problem...
Hold that thought. We'll be right there.
God bless America, land that I love.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Dr. Ray, go right ahead.
Margaret Thatcher once said, and I think it's one of the wisest things she said, the problem with socialism is sooner or later you run out of other people's money. Nobody votes to tax themselves heavily in this fashion. Their instinct is to tax other people. And you can see this in the Obama administration, where so many of them are tax evaders. Tim Geithner, who is the Secretary of the Treasury, was a tax evader. They tried to put Tom Daschle, who was the former majority leader in the Senate, Democrat, in charge of health care. But they discovered that he was a tax evader, too. And there's been one after another. I don't think that's an accident. The aim is to spend other people's money. And the trouble is that when you do that on a sufficient scale, you depress all economic activity. It's often been suggested that the New Deal properly dealt with the Great Depression, but it didn't. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt became president, there was 25% unemployment. In 1941, before the United States entered the Second World War, there was 15% unemployment. Unemployment had gone down a little bit. That was significant for those people who did get jobs, but 15% of the people were still unemployed in 1941. We were still in the Great Depression in 1941 after 8 years of the New Deal. It really didn't solve those problems. In fact, it exacerbated them and kept them going in a serious way because the taxes were so high on well-to-do people, up to something like 90% if you put federal and state taxes together, that there was no point in their investing. So the effect was stagnation in the United States economy, at best, and stagnation at a level much lower than, say, 1928 in terms of well-being in the United States. We didn't get full employment until we were drafting people on a massive scale in the Second World War. And what sustained us in the late 40s and the 1950s is the industrial plant of every other country in the world had been destroyed. We were the only people who were able to produce cars, for example. And so we supplied the whole world. And had things gone on like that, we'd have gone back into a depression in the 1960s. That was avoided because John F. Kennedy...
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Dr. Paul Ray, and we're talking about his book, Soft Despotism, Democracy's Drift. Soft Despotism and Democracy's Gift. Would you like to just once again get your website out and tell people how they can get your book?
Yes, the website is www.paularay, one word, that's PaulaRahe.com. And you can read all about the book there. And from that website, it'll take you to where you can buy it. The book is now in its second printing. It's finding its way from the warehouses of Yale University Press to Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com and other places where you can buy books. And if you order it now, you should be able to get it within a week or so. So it is now, thank God, back available again.
Well, you know, it's very hard to find a book that's really on history and philosophy that is readable, but this is a very readable book. It's very exciting for those of us who are concerned about America and want to know about our history, why America was once a great nation, and why we are losing our freedom today. Because if you don't know where you came from, you certainly don't know where you're going. Well, I think we all know where we're going. We're going into a despotism here in America that will pale, you know, certainly things that have happened in many other tyrannical nations, as all power is being centralized by the government in total violation of our Constitution by people who hate America and who hate individual freedom and have a different elitist agenda. all power in the hands of a ruling elite. Now, certainly Paul was just going ahead and talking about what had happened during the Roosevelt administration. And during the Roosevelt administration, with all of the interference in the economy, very similar to what's going on today. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt became president in 1933, why, of course, we had 25% unemployment. 8 years later, in 1941, before America entered the war, although we were beginning to mobilize for the war, why, we still had 15% unemployment. The economy was not good. Taxes were so high, nobody would bother to take a chance on invest. After all, why would you invest when you were going to be paying 90 to 95% income tax, federal and state? And the basic ideas of certainly President Obama, oh, we're just going to tax the rich. Of course, you tax the rich today. They're talking about 39% federal tax and another 10% for the state tax. And well, you're talking 50%, just that's just for federal and state tax. And if they don't want to be in a city like New York where they have a city income tax as well. But, of course, what happens is we have a city income tax. All the people are making lots of money, simply just move away. And, of course, these people think that the more you tax, the more you get. The truth of the matter is the less you tax, the more you get. But you pick up the story there.
I live in Michigan, and in 1950, the city in the United States with the highest per capita income was Detroit. It's now a place you could possibly live in. And what's happened is the government in Detroit and the government of the state of Michigan have gradually destroyed it. It's spread now from Detroit to the rest of the state. Michigan has had the highest unemployment in the United States for some time now, something like 10 years. I believe they'll have the highest unemployment 20 years from now, because it is not an environment in which anyone in his right mind would invest money in a new business. The taxes are extremely high. The services are extremely poor. You can have a high level of economic development, and you can destroy it. Something like that is happening in California with the scale of the taxes there. Something like that is happening in New York. And people move. They move from high-tax states to low-tax states. And if this is done, if Detroit is the model for the United States, if the Obama administration increases taxes in the way the Roosevelt administration did, and there's no way they can pay for their programs without doing that, just look at the national debt now, the effect of it will be to depress economic growth nationwide for a very, very long time. Americans understand that. We are not as desperate today as we were in 1932 and 1933 with 25% in unemployment. Herbert Hoover brought it to that level. When George Bush left office, unemployment was about 6%. It's going up under Barack Obama. I believe that in 2010, and certainly in 2012, he will be held responsible for the state of the American economy. He will be held responsible for the size of the federal debt. He will be held responsible for the immense taxes that will be voted not just on the well-to-do, but on everyone else as well, because there's no way to pay these taxes on the basis of the wealth of the well-to-do. There will be a huge explosion. I think this is a political opportunity. That is to say, the drift towards soft despotism is no longer unobtrusive. It is radically obtrusive. It means, and people will see that it means, higher heating bills. It will mean massively higher bills for gasoline and for transportation generally. It will mean federal interference in 1,001 ways, as they are doing with regard to General Motors, as they're doing with regard to Chrysler, as they're doing with regard to the merchant banks. People will feel this, and when they feel it, they won't like it. And this offers an opportunity for a pushback against the expansion of the administrative state and the takeover of all of the prerogatives of local government, of private institutions such as charities and private universities, of state universities and so forth, by the federal government. I think that pushback will come in 2010, that there will be a tsunami of support for the Republicans. And I'm hoping that the Republicans have steel enough in their backbones to do something with the opportunity that will be afforded them. There was such a tsunami against the Roosevelt administration in 1938. There was such a tsunami against the administration of Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1966. I think 2010 will be another turning point in American politics. And one of the reasons I wrote this book and published it at the time that I did is what I'm hoping is that it will provide people with the information so that they can understand where they are, how they got there, and where they're going if they do not reassert the traditional American decentralization, federalism, the capacity of Americans through private organizations with public purposes to accomplish things through civic agency as opposed to being worked upon by a Washington elite. I think a time is coming in which there will be a pushback of the sort that would have gratified the heart of Ronald Reagan.
Well, I hope you're right, but I see very little hope for the Republican Party. As a lifelong Republican, I could not believe that they would go along with George Bush and that the Republicans would consistently vote for him. In fact, on many of the issues, the Democrats were far more realistic than the Republicans. And I'm afraid
I don't disagree with you. The Bush years were disheartening. And, you know, he was a sort of typical of what I would call a progressive Republican. You had No Child Left Behind, which involved the federal government intruding even more on local education. There was an attempt to bring the universities to heel by Margaret Spellman at the Department of Education. There was the prescription drug benefit, something that couldn't be paid for on the basis of previously existing taxes. He seemed to want to buy off sections of the Democratic Party with his programs, and his party went along with him in every possible way. Now, they have suffered terribly, that party, for what they did in those years. And I would like to think that they've learned a little bit. And if they haven't learned a little bit, then perhaps the people in the Tea Party movement need to take over the Republican Party. When parties cease to serve a public function, they have a tendency to be taken over by public-spirited people who get angry and upset and enter into active participation in politics in a way they never did before.
Well, you know, one of the things I think that we've forgotten is that if you go back and read Tocqueville, he felt America was great because America was strongly religious, the point that you made earlier. That strong religious situation that we had, you know, back in 1830 really doesn't exist today. We have a watered-down form of Christianity, a happy-go-lucky form of Christianity, very little to do with the Christianity that existed in America in 1830. And, of course, that was the time of the Second Great Awakening, where people were turning back to God, you know, and there was a tremendous revival at that time. I really think that without a revival in America, there is no hope for a return to these concepts of individual freedom under God.
Yeah, I agree with you about that. There has been a concerted attack on religion since 1973, at least, with the decision in Roe v. Wade. There have been attempts on the part of Christians in particular to push back against this. They have not been especially effective. The conduct of the Catholic hierarchy, and I speak as a Catholic, has been disgraceful until very, very recently. I'm hoping, though, that there will be a kind of great awakening again, beginning within the churches. The Catholic Church is now facing a genuine crisis because with socialized medicine will come the requirement that Catholic hospitals provide abortions if they're to receive federal money through Medicare and Medicaid and through socialized medicine. So suddenly they're discovering that the welfare state, which many Catholic bishops have been favorable to, means that they actually lose control over moral decisions. I noticed just recently that the adoption agencies in Massachusetts that the Catholic Church used to run through Catholic Charities have stopped sponsoring adoptions. And the reason is the state law in Massachusetts now requires that they sponsor adoptions for homosexual couples. So there's a sense in which everything's being brought home to people in a way that it wasn't brought home to them before. And that may cause an eruption on the part of Christians in particular, who are increasingly marginalized within this country by an elite that may at election time pretend to be religious, but really have abandoned it altogether. I'm told, by the way, that Barack Obama has not been to church since he became president. And if that's true, it doesn't surprise me one bit.
Well, my hope is, of course, that things are going to get so bad that people will begin looking for an answer. They're not going to find it in most political organizations. Hopefully they'll turn back to God, and that will inspire a true religious change in our political organizations. You know, this is what we need. We have to have, you cannot have a functioning society with limited government unless you have moral people.
Sure. Look, last year, 40% of all children born were born out of wedlock. Those children, in most cases, will not have fathers. They will live in circumstances where their mothers are hard put to earn a living, much less provide them with discipline and care and direction. A society in which 40% of the children are born out of wedlock is a society that's on its way to servitude, because the only body that's going to be able to substitute for the family, and it won't adequately substitute, but it's the only body that people will be able to turn to, is the government. So you will see the intrusion into family life will grow and grow and grow because of the breakdown in family life. There are other aspects of this crisis that I think are very interesting. In the 1940s, Gunnar Myrdal, who wrote a famous book called The American Dilemma about American racial relations, gave a series of lectures at Harvard in which he said countries with social insurance, like Sweden and like the United States with Social Security, are going to face a demographic crisis eventually if they don't do something to head it off. People have children for a great variety of reasons, but one of the motives was that children were going to take care of you when you were old. There was a kind of social contract between the generations. Social Security breaks that. And it's not an accident that in every country with something like Social Security, the birth rate has gone down. And in Europe, everywhere, the birth rate is below replacement. The problem with that is we now live longer. And what that means is the working population grows ever smaller, and the retired population grows ever larger. So there is a sense in which the social democratic model is self-destructive. It implodes because it presupposes that people will have children while removing one of the crucial motives for having children. And the long-term effect of that will be, and it's going to hit Europe very soon and this country very soon, that the Social Security program that we already have can't be paid for by the working population that we have, and that the ratio between the retired and the working will have shifted in such a way that the thing simply can't go on. So there's a sense in which Barack Obama is attempting to carry out a radical socialist revolution at the very moment in which the socialist institutions that we had with a kind of half-socialized, half-commercial economy are imploding and are exploding on us and are falling apart. So that's another reason to have hope, because what is being planned by these people simply cannot work. And again, if the American people are informed of this, which again is why I wrote this book, if they can begin to see what's going on, they can begin to find their way out of the dead end that we're very rapidly moving into.
Well, I can only hope and pray that you're right. I think that we only have to look and see the massive deficit. We're talking about a 1.8 trillion, 1.8, 1 or 2 a trillion dollar deficit for this year, for next year, probably a several trillion dollar deficit, and there's just no way to pay for it. You can't keep borrowing money indefinitely. Other countries aren't going to continue lending it to you. So the only thing to do is monetize the debt, and that destroys the value of the currency. And, of course, there's never been an instance in all history where a nation has had a fiat money system where that has survived. What people do not understand here in America is what happens when your monetary system fails. But I think Alan Greenspan said it best in his book, The Age of Turbulence. There's no better way to destroy a great nation than to debauch its currency. And believe me, certainly George Bush started out debauching it, and certainly Barack Obama is going to complete the job. But we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Paul Ray. His book, Soft Despotism, Democracy's Drift, is an excellent approach to understand the past and the philosophies of Montesquieu and of Rousseau. And, of course, de Tocqueville, three Frenchmen who saw in America a great deal to hope for. Well, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Okay. I think if one thinks about the argument that I've made in this book with regard to what
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh, healthy, easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
I really do believe that the only hope for America would be a return to the religious roots that once made America the envy of the world. And this is one of the things that de Tocqueville wrote about in his book, on democracy. When he came to America, he saw the influence of religion. As he said, you know, I looked every place in America to find, you know, the source of America's greatness. And it was not until I went into the churches of America and heard the pulpits flaming with righteousness that I understood the source of America's greatness. America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. And ladies and gentlemen, that is the problem. We've ceased to be a great or a good nation. We're the greatest exporter of pornography in the world. We are certainly doing everything we can with our policies and our what goes on here to bring about a moral degradation throughout the world. They have intentionally taken God and prayer out of our schools and the Ten Commandments down in a conscious effort to destroy the morality of our children. If you want to know who did it and why, you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Brotherhood of Darkness. You can watch the DVD, but I suggest the book. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. And to understand the motivation of the people who were involved in destroying the moral fabric of our society, you need to hear my talk, Forbidden Secret. That's the Forbidden Secret, and certainly there's a syllabus that goes with that that will help you to understand what is really going on today. That's the Forbidden Secret. There is a secret that's been passed down through the secret societies for 5,000 years. There is a force out there that you can tap into, but you do it at the risk of your eternal soul. And finally, our recent talk, only recently released, on the financial Armageddon and the syllabus that goes with that, how they intentionally and purposely over a long period of time planned on bringing about this financial collapse, not only the United States, but the entire world, because this is a worldwide program. Nations throughout the world, their economies are collapsing, unemployment is rising, people are losing their homes elsewhere, just as they are here. And there's an agenda behind this. What is it? Well, Henry Kissinger said it best in his article in the International Herald Tribune, the 12th of January of this year, entitled A Chance for a New World Order, where he says nations will have two choices, either an international order or chaos. And they're going to do everything they can to promote chaos. It's coming. It's just a matter of time. We're going to see some sort of a major catastrophic event, whether it'll be a contrived epidemic, whether it'll be a contrived terrorist attack. I don't know what it's going to be, but out of this will come increasingly chaos in our country. But people have to understand what's going on. This is why we do what we do 5 hours a day. And we hope you'll go to our website, RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to many of our DVDs, read our newsletters. Certainly you can listen to our radio programs there on the Internet 9 hours a day and not get anything accomplished. But encourage others to listen. Maybe they won't believe. Maybe they'll think we're crazy to begin with. But before long, they're going to be afraid that we're not. And they're going to begin to understand the reason for America's decline from greatness. And our job is to educate people and, of course, hopefully to bring them back to a personal relationship with our Lord. If you'd like to put things into a theological perspective, let me suggest Pastor Billy Crone's excellent DVD series. There are 10 of them, part one and part two of The Final Countdown. The Final Countdown. You can hear the story on CDs if you like to play them in your car in Countdown to Armageddon. We only have the first five of the about 12 or 14 programs that we'll have on this eventually. But certainly you need to understand things from a spiritual and biblical perspective as well. So we ask you, of course, to pray for America, to pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. America is under attack today.
From the mountains to the prairies to the ocean, white with foam, God bless America, my home sweet home. God bless America, land that I
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of David Ray Griffith and Griffin, and Dr. Griffin is a theologian, is retired after working for many years in academia. He's published 35 books on philosophy, religion, and politics. His most recent book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, was a Publisher's Week Pick of the Week in 2008, and his latest book, Osama Bin Laden, Dead or Alive, is a very provocative analysis of the whole concept of really having a boogeyman to rally the people against. And those of you who have read 1984 will remember that Winston, who is the hero of the book, told about, you know, how they were constantly flashing this picture of Goldberg, I think was the name. He was the arch villain. He was the enemy of Big Brother. Big Brother, of course, was the one everybody loved, and Goldberg, or I believe that was his name, was the arch villain. And we don't know whether Goldberg even existed, but they would put his picture on the screen, and everybody in the audience would always boo because he was the enemy. Well, of course, today, Osama bin Laden is the enemy, and, of course, President Bush promised to get him dead or alive. And, of course, President Obama has talked about the necessity of capturing Osama bin Laden. But the question really is Osama bin Laden been dead for many years? And Dr. Griffin has actually analyzed that, so you pick up the story there, please. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Good to be back with you.
Well, tell us, you know, certainly this is something that's always intrigued me. I've been convinced for many years that the Osama bin Laden was dead, that we were simply being rallied behind the favorite villain against the favorite villain. What promoted your desire to write a book about Osama bin Laden, dead or alive?
Well, you know, now that we have officially said we're going to get out of Iraq, the war in Afghanistan remains, and also an illegal, illegitimate war. And the main pretext for that is that we are going to get Al-Qaeda and their leader, Osama bin Laden, the people who really attacked us on 9/11. Well, that was almost a platform, part of the platform for the Democratic Convention. And Obama has repeated many, many times that that we're in Afghanistan and Pakistan, going along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, because that's where we're virtually certain Osama bin Laden is. But if he's dead, as all the evidence indicates, all the reliable evidence, then this is a fool's trip. So either it's we're doing something very foolish, or else this is a pretext.
In fact, was it simply the whole attack on Afghanistan simply to justify something that we already were planning on doing? There's a great deal of evidence that the plans were already drawn up for the attack on Afghanistan before the September 11th attack. Now, if that is true, then all the American boys have died there, and all the Afghans who died have died for nothing, and now we're going to Pakistan. We may be expanding that war. And then, of course, a byproduct of that was going into Iraq with all the problems that they have there, and the wasting of human life, and simply hundreds of billions of dollars that are moving us towards bankruptcy. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. David Ray Griffin. Will you go right ahead with the story? Dr. Griffin?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Oh.
You go right ahead. You were just saying that the pretext for going in and staying in Afghanistan was we're trying to get David Reagan, we're trying to get Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda cleaned out, as if somehow they're really a threat to the United States. But pick up the story, please.
Yeah. So you know, even if one accepts the official story according to which Osama bin Laden and his Al Qaeda cohorts did attack America on 9/11. If Osama is dead, that would make a huge difference in terms of the rationale. I think, you know, there are already big questions about why are we in Afghanistan. And the major answer that the previous president and now the present president give is that we're there to get Osama bin Laden, and yet the evidence suggests that he actually died back in December of 2001. We can even pretty closely pinpoint it to about December 13th or 14th. And of course, this would mean that all the Osama bin Laden videotapes and audio tapes that have been produced since that time are fakes, that someone is fabricating these tapes in order to perpetuate the pretext for this onslaught onto that poor little country, or those two countries.
Are you suggesting that we have something like the Wag the Dog type of war? Remember that one movie that was put out before the September 11th attack, where, of course, they just contrived a justification for a war?
Well, that's certainly what it looks like. And now people will wonder, now when you say that he's been dead since December 13th, what's your evidence for that? Well, first one can say there is no evidence that he's still alive, except for the possibility of the audio tapes or some of the audio tapes and videotapes being authentic. So let's bracket that question for a minute and just look at the positive evidence that he's dead.
Would you hold that thought for just a minute here, because as we begin to analyze the evidence that has been here since early on that Osama bin Laden was dead. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this is David Ray Griffin. We're talking about his book, Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive. And Dr. Griffin is talking about the evidence that has been here for a long time, going back to December of 2001, just a couple of months after the September 11th attack, that Osama bin Laden was dead by that time. So you pick the story up, and many very, very prominent people, even government officials, have suggested that certainly there is very little evidence that people who really are working within the CIA believe that Osama bin Laden is living, or he has been living for a long time. In other words, most of what we're getting is simply, oh, well, the intelligence committee has the intelligence community has verified that this is an authentic tape or this is an authentic video. In fact, we just heard, you know, when President Obama was going overseas, that there was a tape put out by Osama bin Laden that's saying, you know, that how terrible America was. But the problem is, we don't speak Arabic. We don't know whether they're accurate or not. All we know is what we're told by the people who claim to come from the intelligence agencies who tell us that this is Osama bin Laden. But why don't you pick up this story? Because you have so much evidence in your book that we've been lied to and deceived.
Well, one part of the evidence is, strangely enough, that there was a funeral announcement for Osama bin Laden that he had been buried on December 15th, 2001. This was published in Pakistan. It was republished in Egypt. And even Fox News reported it. The second factor is that prior to December 13th, the CIA and other intelligence agencies had been intercepting messages to and from bin Laden. Those came to an end on December 13th. Since that date, there has never been another message to or from bin Laden intercepted. And nobody questions that. Everybody agrees on that. And you put those two things together, and the fact that it's a custom in Muslim countries to bury people very quickly, either the next day or certainly within 2 days, that makes perfect sense then, that if he died on December 13th, that's when communications came to an end, then that he would have been had his funeral on December 15th. So that's pretty strong prima facie evidence right there.
Well, one of the things that's always convinced me that he had to be dead was the fact that he was on renal dialysis. There were reports, lots of reports, before the September 11th attack in 2001 that he was on renal dialysis, and you can't carry out renal dialysis on a regular basis in a cave in Pakistan. When this is something done for people who are in terminal renal disease.
Yes, there was a report in July of 2001 that he was being treated in the American hospital in Dubai. Of course, that story by itself had to be hushed up because he was already supposed to be our number one most wanted terrorist, and there he was reportedly being treated in the American hospital by an American doctor. But be that as it may, the story also reported that he ordered one or two dialysis machines to take back with him to Pakistan, to Afghanistan. The Musharraf of Pakistan, then the president, reported that bin Laden did have a dialysis machine. This was then discussed at some length on CNN. Had on Dr. Sanjay Gupta, and he looked at pictures of bin Laden in the last of the clearly authentic videos and said he had the signs of kidney disease. The skin was very white, even kind of frosting. He was very frail, very gaunt, and it was Sanjay Gupta's opinion that he was probably near death. The same CNN show had one of our leading terrorist experts on shortly thereafter, and he came up with, this was Peter Bergen, he came up with the same conclusion. So there we had further reason to believe that it would have been impossible for bin Laden to continue to keep living and sending out videotapes. And then as you mentioned, several people within our government said they thought bin Laden was dead or probably dead. Ollie North was interviewed by Philip Sheehan of the New York Times, and he said, oh, absolutely, bin Laden is dead. You had Dale Watson, who was head of counterterrorism for the FBI. He said he figured bin Laden was dead. Now, this was back in 2002. Hamid Karzai said bin Laden was probably dead. You even had Israeli intelligence officers saying that bin Laden was dead so that any new messages would be fabrications. And then you even had people in the White House saying that it's a Bush aide, and Rumsfeld early in 2002 saying that it was quite likely that bin Laden was dead. Suddenly then, all of this changed. It was like somebody suddenly decided, you know, we need to keep that guy alive. And all those stories died. There were no more stories about bin Laden being probably dead or definitely dead in 2003 and 2004. And not much, just a few little stories after that of suggesting, well, maybe he's dead. But for the most part, it was that was closed down, and these videotapes started appearing, and the media pretty much chimed in and said, yeah, they're definitely authentic, or they're probably authentic.
I remember the one that supposedly had been found by some unidentified individual in an unidentified house. I think they came up with a city, and supposedly Osama bin Laden was talking to a group of his supporters, admitting he was, of course, responsible for what happened on September 11th. But I remember looking at that tape. First of all, it was all in Arabic. I don't speak Arabic. I couldn't tell what he was saying, but they gave us the captions, and they assured us that what he was saying was that he was responsible for September 11th. But as I looked at him, it certainly didn't look like the pictures of Osama bin Laden I'd seen before. I've heard some people say it looked like him, but I remember looking at that and saying, I don't think that's Osama bin Laden. Even though I couldn't understand a word he was saying, all I had to go with was the English captions down below. I mean, it certainly wasn't very convincing to me. That was, of course, one of the key things, though, to prove that he was still alive, wasn't it? And also to use that here he is admitting. He admits that he was responsible. The Bush administration always said they had all the evidence that proved that he was behind September 11th. But how could he be behind September 11th when now they tell us that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the major architect? He was the fellow down in Guantanamo.
Well, that's not really a contradiction. They'd always said that Osama bin Laden was the one who okayed it, sort of inspired it, but that KSM was the mastermind, the one that worked out the details. So that wasn't really a contradiction. But what's crucial there is that, and I have a whole chapter on the evidence that even before bin Laden had died, back in October and November of 2001, fake videos were being made. So the one you're referring to is the one that was dated November 9th, released December 13th, which coincidentally may be the day that Osama actually died. And as you said, it was supposedly found in a house in Afghanistan, and that in the course of the conversation, he let on that he had planned it, the attacks. Well, there were so many problems with this tape. One is the fact that the previous tape, as I said, he had been very thin and gaunt, and his beard was getting quite white. Suddenly, He weighs maybe 30 pounds more. He's very healthy looking, and he has quite a dark beard. He also has a different shaped nose. And his hands, if you zero in on those, the fingers are shorter, the hands are heavier. And furthermore, we all know that bin Laden was left-handed, and in this video, He writes for a few seconds, and he writes with his right hand. Now, people might say, well, his left arm was paralyzed, because in the last of the authentic, definitely authentic ones, that no, his arm was down to his side. It seemed like he had had a stroke, which incidentally is another sign of kidney disease. But in this one, he lifts his left arm way above his head. So there was nothing wrong with his left arm, and yet he wrote with his right hand.
Well, there are a lot of unanswered questions here, and I think that are we being lied to? Is somebody trying to convince us that Osama bin Laden is still alive, and somehow that then justifies a continue our sending our boys over to Afghanistan? We're sending another 20,000 of them to fight and suffer and bleed and die. Why are we fighting there? Oh, why, my goodness, we've got to stop the poppy trade. The Taliban are terrible. Al-Qaeda is going to get us if we don't watch out. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll go right ahead.
this tape that was dated November 9th, the one with the...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Serious question as to this, but Dr. Griffin is simply pointing out that so many of the things he said were just totally contradictory, because previously he had stated, as a Muslim, I would never lie, and I would not kill innocent women and children, and the women and children in the Twin Towers were innocent. And then he supposedly turning around and said, gee, I plotted the whole thing. So certainly this would point out that he was totally fabricating what he said before, that what he said, he was a Muslim and wouldn't lie. There was just so many things that he said that were totally contradictory, weren't there?
Yes. Now, let me bring this to another point, and that is that many of these videos appeared at very convenient times. So you have to look at the context, what was going on at the time. Well, At the time this video and a previous one appeared, the Bush administration was trying to prove that bin Laden was responsible for 9/11. So this was, let me go back to October of 2001. So we're very shortly after 9/11, and there's still a lot of question about whether the President Bush and his administration have not really provided any evidence that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda were responsible for 9/11. Colin Powell, who was Secretary of State at the time, had promised he was going to put out a paper with the proof. The very next day, he was forced to withdraw that promise. Bush administration told Afghanistan, told the Taliban, we want you to turn over Osama. And they said, we'll be happy to turn him over if you just give us some evidence. And the Bush administration said, this is not a matter of negotiation. Turn him over or else. Tony Blair decided to pick up the mantle there and provide this evidence. So on October 4th, he put out a paper saying there is no doubt whatsoever of the guilt of Osama bin Laden, but in the very document he admitted this doesn't purport to give evidence that would stand up in a court of law. So the BBC called him on this and said, look, the government has really provided no evidence whatsoever. So it's not long after that then that the Brits report, the Telegraph reported, there was a story by David Bamber titled Osama bin Laden, Yes, I Did It. And they claimed that they had a videotape in which bin Laden confessed. And then it was supposed to be revealed in a few days later. But when Blair spoke on that day, he said, well, I don't actually have a copy of the DVD, even though the Telegraph had told us that it had obtained access to this. So this was very strange that the newspaper had access to this video, and yet the Prime Minister couldn't get a copy of it. So it looked like either there was a video that was so obviously fake, they decided they didn't dare release it, or they just made up the idea, and Blair just released a few damning quotations that he said he got from his intelligence officials. So that seems to be the first example we have of a fake video, either an actual video that was made or one the idea was just made up. But then we get this other one that we've been discussing, which appears shortly thereafter. And this appears to be America's attempt. And this one worked out much better. Most people did accept this in spite of all the problems that I've pointed out. But again, the context was they needed to prove that Osama bin Laden was responsible, and they did it by having this video in which he purportedly confessed.
Well, of course, it's all in Arabic, so nobody can, unless, of course, he's fluent in Arabic, to know what he's really saying. But the whole idea is just trust us now. This is what he's saying. Read those captions there in English, and I'm sitting there in my living room watching this and saying, but how do I know those captions have anything to do with what he's saying? And you probably checked it out. They probably do. But I will have to admit that I had a feeling when I saw that videotape, I remember thinking, I think we're being had. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's David Ray Griffin. And please go right ahead with your description.
Well, the point you make about not knowing Arabic and therefore not being able to judge brings us to another point. as I said, many of the, I have a whole chapter on a number of tapes, audio tapes and videotapes, purportedly from bin Laden, that appeared at extremely convenient times for the Bush administration. It was almost as if every time they needed the boogeyman to appear, he obliged. Well, the most important of these is the one that is sometimes called the October Surprise video. This was in 2004, just 4 days before the presidential election, October 29th. And suddenly, here comes this bin Laden tape. And this one differed from all previous bin Laden tapes in that in this one, he was directly addressing the American people. And in the course of his address, he admitted again that he was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. He even claimed that he had been planning to attack the Twin Towers since 1982, which made me think not only is he the world's biggest terrorist, he's the world's biggest procrastinator. In this one, he's somewhat younger and healthier again than he had appeared in those undoubtedly authentic videotapes at the end of 2001. He also has a very different message. This bin Laden is a rationalist. And he's not even particularly religious in his language. When you go back and look at his undoubtedly authentic ones, he refers to God, to Allah, many, many times, and also to Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad. In this one, even though it's quite a long address, he referred to God only 12 times, whereas on average, a tape this long, he would have referred to God maybe 30 times or more, did not refer to the Prophet Muhammad once, and that's just unheard of. The only Muhammad he mentioned was Muhammad Atta.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. And, of course, one of the things that Dutch Griffiths is pointing out is that this tape that came out just a few days before the 2004 presidential election is just 3 or 4 days before the going to the polls to vote. Why Osama bin Laden is coming out. But the question is this really Osama bin Laden? Because his message is entirely different. He refers to God only perhaps 10, 12 times where ordinarily you'd expect him in his previous tapes, authenticated tapes, 30 times. And he never refers to Muhammad other than to Muhammad Atta, but not to Muhammad the Prophet, who is the foundation of his faith, who he ordinarily would have referred to many times. So maybe he's got a different script writer this time. Under any circumstances, it was very, very convenient for George W. Bush to have this tape come out, which, of course, would rally a lot of people behind George Bush, because obviously Osama bin Laden doesn't want George Bush to be elected. Go right ahead.
Yes, and indeed, the tape gave Bush a huge boost in the polls. And in fact, the CIA looked at it, the fellows in the CIA, and decided that this tape was designed to assist Bush. And both Bush himself and John Kerry credited this tape for Bush's victory, that it made the margin of error, the margin of difference, where they'd been very close up till that point. Bush ended up winning by several points. But now I come to the point about language. Osama bin Laden spoke, as some people put it, impeccable English. He had gone to English-speaking classes from a very young age. Then he had gone to the university. Somebody interviewed him one time in English and said he just spoke very good, very fluent English. He was very comfortable in it. Well, in this case, if this was the real Osama bin Laden, and he's addressing the American public, why did he not use English? Now, in all of his other tapes, he's addressing his people in the Arab world, so it makes sense. Of course he would speak Arab. But in this case, he's addressing the American people. He speaks English very well. Why would he not have used it? So that's not the only reason to say this tape is a phony, but it's one of the reasons, and I think a pretty good reason.
It's really rather disheartening to realize how readily the American people are manipulated.
Well, yes, and the press is so much responsible for this because they're so irresponsible in terms of how they treat these things. On some of the tapes, and then I should say the longest chapter in the book goes through and analyzes a large number of the tapes, the most important of the tapes, and shows that not a single one of them can definitely be said to be authentic, and that some of them can almost definitely be said to be fake, such as the one I just mentioned. And also one that I call Blackbeard the Terrorist. In 2007, another tape showed up, and this time bin Laden, who had been back in 2001, his beard had been getting whiter and whiter. Suddenly in 2007, he has a perfectly black beard. It's important to know that it's not legitimate for pious Muslims to dye their beard, certainly not black, except in very extreme circumstances, which would not have applied here. And yet the press just treated this as, of course it's authentic, and tried to make up excuses, like saying, well, you know, maybe he's living in a country where the men don't wear beards, so he had shaved off his beard. But now to do the video, he decided to put a beard on, a fake beard. And so that's how we explain that. As if Osama bin Laden's people, if, you know, there'd been any truth to this, it could not have gone out and found a more authentic-looking beard than that. But that's how the press will stretch and rationalize and make excuses to avoid admitting that this was obviously a fake video.
And the difficulty is if we can't, you know, trust the press, who can we trust? Somebody once said that, you know, if you don't read the newspaper, why, you're uninformed. But if you do read the newspaper, you're misinformed. So it's really not much better. But go right ahead.
It is a problem. And, you know, this latest tape that came out just before Obama was to speak, there was simply no basis for calling that authentic, and yet our CIA immediately said it was authentic. And CBS News quoted some unnamed intelligence official, and this is something that's done all the time. They'll say, authorities say, a high intelligence official says, and they quote these things without any skepticism. And they quoted this, CBS quoted this guy as saying, there has never been a fake Osama bin Laden tape. Well, that is at least debatable, but CBS did not even raise the question as to whether that might not be the whole truth.
Well, you know, I was very interested in the quotation you have in your book from Robert Baer. He's certainly one of my favorite CIA experts, and we've read all three of his books, and we carry at least one of them, his See No Evil book. But certainly you quote what Robert Baer, who is a long time, 25 years in the CIA, said about bin Laden. Would you want to mention that? Because I think that is very important when you're dealing with somebody who does have contacts within the CIA today.
Well, yes. I actually begin the book and end it with Robert Baer. And for any listeners who don't know, he's a former CIA operative. He wrote the book on which the movie Syriana was somewhat based, that George Clooney movie. And he was on Terry Gross's show, Fresh Air, near the end of 2008. And kind of in passing, he said, well, of course, bin Laden's dead, and just moved on as if, doesn't everybody know that? And she came back in a few minutes and said, now, just a minute, a few minutes ago, you said, Osama bin Laden is dead. And Baer said, well, of course he's dead. He says, you know, there hasn't been any word from him since late in 2001. And then he reported that he took a poll among people who are still in the CIA and are supposed to be on the trail of bin Laden and asked him, what about, is he dead or alive? And he said not a single one of them could say he's alive. Not a single one had any basis for saying with confidence he's still alive.
But, of course, you're never going to hear this through regular channels. That's why this book is really so very important. And, again, the name of the book is Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive by David Ray Griffiths. Go right ahead, please.
Another former intelligence fellow is named Codavia. He now teaches at Boston University. He used to be in the Foreign Service. And he just rather recently wrote a book wrote an article called Osama bin Elvis. And he argues there's more evidence that Elvis is still with us than that bin Laden is.
I love that line. I thought it was very apropos.
Yeah. Now, let me add one thing. A lot of people have raised the question, well, don't we know that bin Laden's dead because Benazir Bhutto said so and talked about Omar Sheikh as the man who had murdered Osama bin Laden. And some people who have evidently read my book but didn't read the notes have faulted me for not mentioning that. I actually discussed it in the notes in a reference to Codavia's work, and I said, well, he did refer to one bit of evidence that I don't, and that is that tape. This was when Benazir Bhutto was interviewed by David Frost shortly before she was assassinated. And she did make that statement, but all the evidence suggests that she meant to say Omar Sheikh, the man who had murdered Daniel Pearl. Because that's what Omar Sheikh is known as. Everybody refers to him now as the man who murdered Daniel Pearl. She had just mentioned one of bin Laden's sons just before she said that, so she had the name bin Laden in her head. And just a few days after that interview, she twice referred to bin Laden, like with some people who were supposed to be guarding her. There, she said, well, why aren't you out chasing Osama bin Laden? So she said that twice within a few days, something like that. So I think it's pretty clear that she just misspoke. So people shouldn't refer to the Benazir Bhutto quote. And I refer in there to a very good video that's on YouTube in which all this evidence is put together, that she clearly didn't. So there is very strong evidence that bin Laden is dead, but part of that evidence is not the statement by Benazir Bhutto.
Well, Sidney, as you go through and you have a tremendous amount of evidence that he's dead, there's no evidence he's alive. In fact, I love that line by Donald Rumsfeld about the only thing he ever said that I would agree with, and that is that Donald Rumsfeld at a press conference said, well, I can tell you one thing, you know, Osama bin Laden's either dead or alive. Of course,
he always likes to get a laugh, and he tried that line once and got a good laugh, so he tried it again later, and that was during the period. In fact, he was one of the few who made that kind of statement even later on, that he had no knowledge that bin Laden was still alive.
Well, I don't think that anybody with, you know, terminal kidney disease and has to be on dialysis, you know, is going to be able to survive very long without adequate medical care. It just this doesn't happen. And certainly some of the last videos that we know were bin Laden, he looked very ill and he seemed to be paralyzed on the left side. And so we haven't seen any videos of him in recent years, have we?
Well, I say that one it came out in 2007 with a perfectly black beard. So if you mean have we seen any videos of the real bin Laden, no. But the purported bin Laden does keep emerging. Now, that one was so obviously phony that there's a very funny spoof of it on the internet, and I quote that in the book, where this guy comes on, he's got a very black beard, it's very long, goes almost to the ground, and he says, hello, me Osama bin Laden, long time no see, I just want to assure you this no commercial for men only hair dye. You know, it's very, very funny, and it shows that this stuff is so patently phony that people are laughing at it, and yet on the mainstream news, people are discussing this with a straight face. We wonder sometimes how many takes they have to take to keep a straight face. But it's all deadly serious that Osama bin Laden is there in the on the border between, you know. And we had this recently, a guy at UCLA who had worked up a geographical analysis of where bin Laden must be hidden, and the press took this very seriously. Rachel Maddow even, I think, gave the guy 7 to 10 minutes one night on her show to explain his theory, how he had narrowed it down to where bin Laden must be. And you know Christina Borgeson, who has written some books very critical of the press, the lack of skepticism, and she had written an article. Unfortunately, I didn't learn about it before my own book was going to press, talking about the lack of skepticism in the press. Well, she wrote me the other day and said that she contacted this fellow and said, you know, your theory is very interesting, but did you deal with the possibility that maybe bin Laden isn't hiding anywhere because he's dead? And she said, the guy said, oh, no, that thought hadn't occurred to him.
Well, we've actually carry a book by Christine. She's really did a great job. Of course, she lost her, her occupation, you know, is in the regular mainline media because she told the truth. And her book, Into the Buzzsaw, is a compilation of a number of people who certainly are no longer writing for the mainline media or television simply because they had the audacity to tell the truth. In fact, one of them ended up shooting himself in the head twice to commit suicide. That was Gary Webb, who had an essay in that in Christine's book. So basically, you know, the frightening thing is, of course, it's very important whether Osama bin Laden is dead or alive, because this is the major justification that's being used today, that why we have to be in Afghanistan. And if bin Laden is dead, Al-Qaeda is really not a threat to us. The only thing we're doing is antagonizing the Muslim world by staying in Afghanistan and keeping our troops permanently stationed in Iraq. And they are going to be permanently stationed there. Ladies and gentlemen, if you really think they're coming home next year, I think you're sadly, sadly mistaken. We're going to be back in just a moment with David Ray Griffin to wrap up tonight's program.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh. Healthy. Easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Because, you see, if we've been lied to, then somebody is guilty of the murder of 3,000 Americans. There's no statute of limitation on that. And, of course, they really wanted almost 6,000 to die. They kept telling the people in the South Tower to stay at their seats, don't get up and leave, ignore what's going on with the North Tower, which is on fire. Stay at your seats. And it wasn't, if it had not been for the chief of security in the South Tower, running up and down the aisles at Morgan Stanley and evacuating somewhere between 2,400 and 2,700 Morgan Stanley employees. Another almost 3,000 people have died that day. In fact, they were anticipating it. They kept saying over and over again, 6,000 people died. 6,000 people died. And then when they realized that the people from Morgan Stanley had gotten out, why, of course, they kept dropping the number down to about 2,700. Remember, 1,100 bodies have never been recovered. They were vaporized that day. How could they have been vaporized if this was a pancake collapse, as we've been told? We have a number of excellent DVDs on the subject. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for 911 Mysteries and 911 What Really Happened. We've got a whole flock of them. They are all available by calling 1-800-544-8927 or simply go to our webpage, and then you can get our four tape sets. Why did the buildings come down? What really happened that day? My interview with Laura Chavez, who was actually the headquarters in Florida there, Tampa, Florida, military headquarters, and said there was a stand-down order. The planes were not to fly, and Laura Chavez has sort of disappeared. I had one of the last interviews with him before he was no longer available. But you'll hear my interview with him, my interview with Jimmy Walter, who is now living and hiding in Europe because of the threats on his life, for daring to bring out the truth. So the DVDs, Why Did the Buildings Come Down and What Really Happened on 911 and 911 Update, four tape sets, and then get the DVDs. Or just simply go to our website, radioliberty.com, go to the section on other videos and scroll down to Building 7 and watch Building 7 come down. It was a controlled demolition. It was a controlled demolition, and the question is, how did Osama bin Laden do that? Or if he didn't do that, who then was responsible for the murder of 3,000 Americans then, and all the boys have died fighting in Iraq and Iran? And there's so much we're not being told. You need to help us to get the information out. We've got to get the American people to break loose from the mind control. We are being lied to by the media. That's why I do what I do 5 hours a day, hoping people will begin to understand the media is controlled. If you want to understand what's really going on financially, you need to see our new talk, Financial Armageddon, and the syllabus that goes with that, that contains Andrew Jackson's, President Jackson's farewell address in 1837, where he described what happened at that time with the battle with the bank. And the same thing is happening right today. There's so much other great information in there you will not find elsewhere. All of our newsletters are there, and you need to read them and reread them, and then government documents. The Congressional Oversight Panel trying to find out what happened to the TARP funds. They can't find out what happens to the TARP funds. It's all being shrouded in mystery and the letters going back and forth. The last thing they want the American people to understand is we're transferring the wealth of the American people and unborn generations to a small group of wealthy people tied into the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. Our number again, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. From the mountains.